All right, so today we're gonna dive into a Supreme Court case that kind of sets some ground rules for how our legal system works when it comes to federal laws and where those cases end up. You know, state court versus federal court. Taflin v. Levitt. It's a pretty interesting one.
It is
And
very
it
interesting.
really gets to the heart of can state courts handle those civil lawsuits that are based on the federal RIO statute?
That's the one, yeah, the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, RIO.
RO, exactly. And that's what we're going to unpack today is, you know, can state courts handle those cases, or is that something that's exclusive to the federal system?
Right, and what's really fascinating about this is that this decision, it has an impact on where, these legal fights, these legal battles might actually happen,
Oh, yeah, like choosing your battleground.
Think of it like choosing your battlefield, right? The
Yeah.
state courthouse or the federal courthouse.
Oh, I like that.
And Taflin helps us to really define those boundaries for these civil REO claims.
So let's give our listeners a little bit of background on how this case even made it all the way to the Supreme Court.
Sure.
It all starts with the collapse of Old Court Savings and Loan in Maryland. And following that collapse, investors who had bought certificates of deposit, they decided to sue, alleging some serious violations of federal securities law. And this is where it ties into our topic today, civil law RICO violations
Against those in charge.
against the people in charge. Exactly. And so initially, the federal district court actually dismissed the case,
They did.
but not because they said, you know, the RICO claims didn't have any merit. It wasn't about that at all.
Right.
It was that they said, hey, state courts are perfectly capable of handling
Yeah,
this.
they actually, they reasoned that state courts were perfectly capable of handling those civil RICO claims, and in fact, they decided to abstain,
Right.
essentially step aside, because there was already related litigation happening in the Maryland state courts.
Ah, so that was really the catalyst to kick this up to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, that's what ultimately led to the Supreme Court taking a look at this.
Okay, so that brings us to the central question we're diving into today, and that is this concept of concurrent jurisdiction, this general rule that says state courts can hear federal cases. Does that automatically mean they can hear civil RICO claims too?
That's the question.
It seems straightforward, but I have a feeling it's anything but.
It sounds straightforward, but trust me, there are always layers when we start talking about these legal questions, right?
Yeah. So tell me about this concept of concurrent jurisdiction, because that seems like a pretty fundamental piece of this whole puzzle.
Yeah, absolutely. So this idea, the presumption of concurrent jurisdiction, it's really a fundamental concept in our legal system.
Okay.
The starting point is that we assume state courts are just as competent as federal courts to hear cases involving federal law.
Interesting.
It's like saying, unless somebody specifically says otherwise, both teams are allowed to play the game, right?
Okay, so that's the default. So what was it about Taflin that made the Supreme Court decide, yep, state courts, we're good with this. You can handle these civil RI cases?
Well, the court's decision really hinged on that presumption of concurrent jurisdiction, and crucially on what the RICO statute itself doesn't say.
Okay.
So when you look at the text of RIO, specifically section 1964C,
Okay.
that's the part that really allows individuals to sue for damages caused by RICO violations.
Right.
The engine for these civil lawsuits, there's no language in there that explicitly says only federal courts can hear these cases.
Interesting.
The absence of those magic words like exclusive jurisdiction, something like that was really key because that language wasn't present, that presumption that state courts could hear these claims that remained in place.
Okay, so Congress, if they wanted to keep this solely within the federal court system, you would think they would have written that.
You would think so, yeah.
But they didn't. So then what was the argument that the investors in Taflin were making, because they were really adamant that these RICO claims needed to stay in federal court?
Yeah, they were arguing that they were pointing to another federal law, the Clayton Act, which deals with antitrust issues, and the Clayton Act, that one explicitly says that federal courts have exclusive jurisdiction over those types of cases.
Got it.
And so the investors in Taflin, they argued that RICO is similar to the Clayton Act in that it allows private individuals to sue for damages under federal law.
Right. I see what they're saying.
Yeah. So they were essentially saying, well, if it's similar to Clayton in that way, it should be treated the same way in terms of which courts can hear those cases.
Okay. So So both create a private right of action
Exactly.
under federal statutes. But the Supreme Court wasn't buying that, were they?
They weren't persuaded by that comparison at all.
Nope. Yeah.
Justice O'Connor, she wrote the opinion for the court in this case, and she really pushed back on that analogy. She emphasized that just because one federal law, you know, grants exclusive jurisdiction, it doesn't automatically mean that another one, even if it shares some similarities, should be interpreted in the same way without clear evidence that Congress intended that.
Okay.
So the court wasn't willing to just assume Congress meant to limit RE2A to federal courts just based on the structure of a different law.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And what's also fascinating is that the court also reaffirmed its belief in the competence of state courts.
Okay.
You know, to correctly apply federal law.
Right.
They pointed out that if a state court does make a mistake in interpreting federal law, well, those decisions can ultimately be reviewed by the Supreme Court.
Right. Okay. So it really comes down to this idea that Congress has to be really clear and specific if they want to take that power away from the state courts.
Exactly. Unless Congress sends a clear signal, state courts are considered capable and authorized to handle these federal claims.
Okay. So let's dig into that a little bit deeper. How exactly does the court say that this presumption of concurrent jurisdiction can be overcome?
Right. So the Supreme Court laid out three main ways that this starting assumption that state courts can hear federal cases can be rebutted.
Okay.
First, and this is the most straightforward, is explicit statutory text.
Right.
If the law itself clearly states that federal courts have exclusive jurisdiction, that's the end of the discussion.
Right.
Second, if there's an unmistakable trail of legislative history, you know, those records of congressional debates, committee reports, that sort of thing, that clearly show Congress intended to reserve jurisdiction solely for federal courts.
Okay.
Now, this would need to be really, really clear, not just a hint or a passing thought.
Got it.
And then third, if there's a clear incompatibility between state courts hearing a particular type of federal claim and the federal interests at stake.
Okay.
So this might happen if having state courts involved would undermine the uniformity or the effectiveness of the federal law. So in the case of Civil Arturo, the court looked at all three of these and they found that none of them applied.
Okay, so that gives us a really good understanding of the framework that the court is using here.
Mm-hmm.
And we also know that there were some concurring opinions in Taflin.
Right.
Justice White and Justice Scalia both wrote concurring opinions.
They did.
So what did they have to add to this discussion?
Well, you know, Justice White, while agreeing with the court's decision, he offered a concurring opinion that kind of highlighted a potential concern.
Okay.
And he pointed out the possible risks involved in having state courts interpret these underlying criminal acts that need to be proven in a civil RACO case.
Right, like the predicate acts.
Exactly. The predicate criminal acts, think of these as the specific criminal offenses like fraud or bribery, things like that,
yeah,
that form the basis of the RACO violation.
Right.
And Justice White was concerned that different state courts might develop different interpretations of these federal crimes, which could potentially lead to inconsistencies.
Mm, that's a good point.
Right. But despite this concern, he ultimately agreed with the majority.
Okay.
Expressing his faith in the ability of state judges to apply federal law correctly.
Okay.
And emphasizing the Supreme Court's role as a final arbiter to ensure uniformity. So, you know, kind of a trust but verify stance.
Trust but verify. I like that. And what about Justice Scalia? We know he's famous for his textualist approach. So what was his take on this?
Right. Well, Justice Scalia's concurrence was very much in line with that textualist philosophy.
Okay.
He argued that, you know, when deciding who can hear a case, we should really focus solely on the actual words of the statute.
The text itself.
The text itself. For him, legislative history, you know, those records of congressional debates and all that shouldn't really play a role.
Interesting.
His main point was that if Congress wants federal courts to have exclusive jurisdiction, they need to say it directly in the law.
Okay.
Relying on, you know, implied intent from legislative history
wasn't
something that he was a fan of.
So how did he tie that back to this idea of state court authority?
Yeah. So Justice Scalia went further and emphasized his belief that state courts inherently have the power to hear cases, including those involving federal law.
Okay.
He argued that state courts, they don't need Congress to give them permission to hear these cases.
Interesting.
Instead, he said it takes a specific action based on the supremacy clause of the Constitution to actually take away that inherent power from state courts.
Okay.
So for him, the starting point is that state courts can hear these cases unless Congress clearly steps in and says, no, you can't.
That's fascinating. And now one more piece of this I want to touch on is that the court in Taflin also agreed with the district court's decision to abstain, to not hear the case. So why did that happen? And what is this whole abstention doctrine about?
Right. So the court upheld the abstention because there are already similar legal proceedings happening in the Maryland state courts.
Mm-hmm.
And the abstention doctrine, it's essentially a principle that allows the federal court to choose not to hear a case, even if it has the authority to do so under certain specific circumstances.
Yeah.
One of the main reasons for this is to avoid having two different courts dealing with basically the same issues at the same time.
Right. That makes sense.
Which can be inefficient and lead to conflicting decisions.
Yeah.
In the context of Taflin letting the state courts in Maryland go ahead with those lawsuits,
mm-hmm.
it promoted judicial efficiency, and it also respected the principles of federalism by letting the state court handle matters that were already in its system.
So it sounds like it was really a pretty practical decision rooted in efficiency and just how our whole system is set up.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about the real world consequences of Taflin for lawyers and their clients.
Sure.
I mean, how does this ruling affect where these civil RICO lawsuits can be filed?
Well, the most significant practical consequence of Taflin is that it clearly established that civil RICO claims can be filed in either state or federal court.
Right.
So this gives the plaintiffs, the people bringing those lawsuits, the choice of where to bring their case.
Okay.
And that choice can be strategically very important.
How?
Well, for example, a plaintiff might prefer a state court because the procedural rules might be more favorable to their case.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe the state court schedule could lead to a faster resolution. Yeah, things like that.
Okay.
On the other hand, there might be reasons why a plaintiff might still prefer federal court.
Right.
Such as the judge's specialized experience with complex federal law.
Okay, that makes sense.
So Taflin opened up this strategic option for anyone considering a civil REO lawsuit. And, you know, for you as a future lawyer, understanding this can be a crucial part of your litigation strategy.
Right. So it's not just this abstract legal question of who can hear these cases. It actually really impacts how these legal battles are fought and ultimately the outcome, too.
Exactly. It adds a whole other layer of strategy.
Yeah.
You know, legal counsel, they have to consider the pros and cons of each state versus federal.
Okay, so as we wrap up this deep dive, what would you say is the key takeaway from Taflin v. Leavitt that our listeners should really remember?
The central takeaway, I would say, is that Taflin really reinforces the principle of concurrent jurisdiction,
mm-hmm.
that state courts are considered equal partners in enforcing federal law, unless Congress explicitly says otherwise.
Yeah.
You know, and this decision, it highlights the importance of our federal system and that general competence of state courts to handle even these really complex federal claims.
Right.
And that ultimately contributes to the overall efficiency of our judicial system.
So just to reiterate, for anyone who's dealing with federal statutes, you know, in the legal world, what's the most important thing to remember?
The crucial point is to always carefully examine the specific language of the federal statute. If Congress intends to give exclusive jurisdiction to federal courts, they're usually going to say that directly in the law.
Okay.
And if that language isn't there, the default assumption is that state courts are open to hear that claim.
So always go back to the source, the actual words.
Exactly.
Well, this has been a really insightful deep dive into Taflin v. Leavitt. And it's really helped us understand the relationship between state and federal courts a lot better.
It's a great illustration of how these seemingly technical legal questions actually have very real and practical implications.
Yeah, absolutely. Uh-huh. So for our listeners, I'll leave you with this final thought.
Okay.
How might this decision shape the future of litigation,
mm-hmm.
especially when it comes to these complex cases involving federal statutes?
Yeah.
Think about areas like financial regulation or consumer protection.
Right.
You know, what kinds of strategic choices are now available to the people bringing these claims?
Mm-hmm.
And how does all of this impact that balance of power between federal and state courts in making sure our laws are enforced?
Those are great questions.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
It was my pleasure.
We'll see you next time.
See ya.